Hi, welcome to the JRB podcast. I'm Abe Socher, your host and the editor of the Jewish Review of Books. Today I talked with my friend Stuart Halpern. Stu is senior advisor to the provost of Yeshiva University and deputy director of YU's Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought. He's also the editor of Esther in America, a fascinating anthology. We talked about some of the surprising ways that Americans, both Jews and non-Jews, have used the story of Esther over the years. Stu is also a recent Ola, and he tells us what it feels like to be in Israel this year as Purim arrives. I enjoyed our conversation, and I think you will too. Stu Halpern, welcome to the JRB podcast. It's really great to see you again. We're recording right before Purim, and a few years ago you published a really great book called Esther in America. We'll be getting to that soon, but first, what's your favorite memory of Purim as a kid?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's really an honor and a pleasure to be here. I must disclose up front that I'm coming to you live from, believe it or not, Esther Hamalka Street, Queen Esther Street.
Really?
Here in Modi'in, Israel. I live in a neighborhood where each street is named after a strong biblical woman, and I live on the best line. Oh. What can I say? So as a kid, I grew up in Forest Hills, New York, and I remember actually my mom for many years spent many, many hours putting together the shul communal mishloach manot. Not everyone can run around on Purim day delivering to dozens of families. So there was the communal one that folks can chip in on. And I remember how excited she would be when she found the perfect basket full of goodies that were, most importantly, kosher for Passover, because she presumed that not everyone would finish their giant gargantuan shul mishloach manot basket. And it was key that it would be chametz free. So that's one memory I have. And another, just simply, probably when I was around 11 or 12, I started noticing that there was a point in the Megillah where people started to boo, and it wasn't at Haman's name. And I was very confused. And then and then I realized that it was at the levying of the mas, the taxes, that Ahasuerus levied over his kingdom following the victory of Mordechai and Esther. And it took me a few years to appreciate what was going on then. But now, rest assured, I boo as enthusiastically as when I boo Haman to stomp out his name. So those are just a couple of childhood memories for me when it comes to Purim.
Yeah, I don't think, I'm a little older than you. I don't think I noticed that till about 20 years ago when we were already in Cleveland. On the other hand, most of those previous years, I was in one college town or another. And of course, you know, one's
everyone's
less
living
likely
off of mom and dad's
boo
credit card. No one's paying taxes there.
Something like that. Well, you live in Israel. You made Aliyah a couple of years ago. Do you think your kids' Purim is different than yours?
So
than yours was growing up?
Most definitely. I mean, in a normal year, I mean, there's sort of a half normal experience in Israel, half obviously not in light of the ongoing war. But the normal experience is Purim in Israel is nothing like Purim in America. By that, it means it lasts roughly somewhere between 2 weeks and a month. You know, by Rosh Chodesh Adar, maybe even Aleph, by the first day of the month of Adar, the costumes are already coming out. School basically becomes a series of carnivals and packing mishloach manot to this year to soldiers. And I get the sense more and more that essentially no learning is being done. So I said to one of my seven-year-olds, I have twins, one day, and I said, hey, you know, what'd you do in school today? Did you get any learning done? And he said, no, you know, we just had a Purim carnival. Meanwhile, this was 2 weeks in advance of the actual day. And so I wondered to myself, well, if you're not learning, why am I paying all that tuition? And then I realized, I'm in Israel. I'm not paying tuition. So that was some comfort in that regard. On the flip side, very relevant, of course, is the Megillah's articulation of a decree by Persians to slaughter Jews, Taflan Hashim, you know, young and men, women, and children. And so one of my aforementioned twins turned to the other in anticipation of us coming back to the U.S. for the summer and said, by the way, are there rockets in New Jersey? Do you remember? You know, so that's one of the just sort of views into what it's like having young children during this wartime. And we actually just had a baby a few months ago. Thank you so much. One of her names is after a yellet that fell on October 7th, a heroic commander of a drone unit. And so when this baby was born, one of my kids started, you know, sort of baby talking to her and saying, by the way, you know, Mindy, everybody loves you. Everyone loves you. And another one of my kids said, well, Hamas doesn't love you. And so there's this tension, of course, between trying to celebrate normally and enjoy the many weeks of Purim that are offered here in Israel with very little official classroom time. But on the other hand, this is still very real, and many of the youth from our synagogue will be missing from the Megillah because they will be out fighting and defending our people and our country. So definitely the story rings particularly relevant this year.
So let's jump back 200 or 300 years. So your book, Esther in America, fascinating, surprising book published by Koren a couple of years ago. What made Megillat Esther so interesting to early Americans?
So fascinatingly enough, in the decade before the American Revolution, the colonists were wrestling with the morals, the ethics of rebelling against a tyrannical regime, namely, of course, the British, King George III. They weren't quite yet ready to have an open revolt, to actively fight back, but they knew they were upset. They knew they were frustrated. And so they were in need of some sort of story to offer a prism through which to view their own struggle in this particular context. And so they turned, perhaps rather surprisingly, to the story of Esther, which, like their own situation, presented a case whereby there were an oppressed minority, and they felt, well, we're being hit with all these oppressive laws, similar to the Jews of Shushan being hit with Haman's oppressive decree to wipe them out. And yet they wanted to, at least at first, in these few years leading up to the revolution, blame not the king, but his nefarious minister. So the Haman in the pre-revolutionary America was actually the prime minister, or the prime ministers, there were a couple of them, of England. And so they said Lord North, Lord Bute, they were the ones who were suggesting, whispering in the ear of King George III, who maybe, like Ahasuerus, frankly, wasn't minding his business and wasn't paying attention to what was going on and was relegating his authority to second in command. So maybe it was this prime minister slash Haman-like figure who was really at fault when it came to, say, things like taxation without representation. And so the colonists tried to excuse, on some level, the behavior of George III by writing in various newspapers from New York to Boston that maybe he, like King Xerxes, who scholars suggest was Ahasuerus, was essentially not paying attention and handing the kingdom off to a conniving, tyrannical minister. What's particularly fascinating is, I would imagine, those Bostonians and New Yorkers, no offense to them, did not know the Talmudic debate whether King Ahasuerus was a foolish king or an evil king, which is actually something that the rabbis themselves debate. Was he someone who actually actively sought to destroy the Jews and was just thrilled that Haman had given him an excuse? Or was he just out to lunch and frankly just hanging out in his harem and not caring much about anything beyond that? And of course, once eventually the Revolutionary War broke out, they pivoted to another prism, namely the prism of Passover, to explain how they were now fighting against an actual tyrannical monarch, which of course, Paro, Melech Mitzrayim, King Pharaoh of Egypt, became their paradigmatic enemy. And shameless plug, but I just released a Haggadah called The Promise of Liberty, which delves deeply into that phenomenon of the story of Pesach, Passover, resonating in American politics. But that, of course, is not the topic of our conversation today. So apologies for that shameless plug.
We should have you back for that. As I recall, you wrote in the Esther book about the Puritan leader Cotton Mather. So first, just remind us who Cotton Mather was and maybe why he had that weird name before we get to important things. And then more importantly, tell us how he read the Book of Esther.
That's interesting. I don't know why. I could tell you about his father's name. Why was his name?
I
don't know that one.
My dad, you talked about your mom. My dad loved this fact. I think it's a fact. So his dad was Increase Mather, which is the translation for Yosef. So he named his son, one of his sons, Katan, you know, as not increase, but smaller. So that becomes Cotton.
That is awesome. And I'm ashamed and embarrassed that I didn't know it. And that is fantastic.
Well, somebody may call in and tell us it's actually not true.
It's as our dear friend Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik would say, it's too good to check. Too good to check. So Cotton Mather, he was a prolific author. I think he wrote something in the realm of 400 books and pamphlets over his 65 years or so. He was a Puritan minister who lived from 1663 to 1728. He was a scientist and owner of the largest private library in the colonies. He was the grandson of the Massachusetts Bay Colony spiritual leaders Richard Mather and John Cotton, and he was the son of Harvard president Increase Mather. So Cotton, not being a Jew, though he loved to attempt to convert Jews, I guess that was his side hustle in between writing 400 books, he wrote a manual for how women should behave, as I'm sure JRB readers and listeners don't need to be told. Puritans had very strong thoughts on how women should be behaving. And so he wrote a book called, just I'm sure everyone's running to jot this down and immediately order it on Amazon, Ornaments for the Daughters of Zion, or The Character and Happiness of a Virtuous Woman in a Discourse which Directs the Female Sex How to Express the Fear of God in Every Age and State of Their Life and Obtain Both Temporal and Eternal Blessedness.
Snappy.
So it just, that title kind of rolls off the tongue. I'm sure his publisher was thrilled with it. And that was published in 1692. And so he, despite not being Jewish, had a fascination or turned to as a model, not to a figure from the Christian tradition, like Mary, for example, but actually felt that as a paragon of virtue, behavioral virtue, none other than Esther should be turned to for inspiration by the women of his time. So, for example, he wrote in this book, opportunities are those that a woman has to bring over her husband unto real and serious godliness. And a good woman will use those opportunities. And Esther, a witty Esther, what can she do with the most haughty husband in the world? In other words, he felt that Esther modeled bringing godliness and improving morally and, frankly, cutting down to size an arrogant husband. Now, he was obviously taking some literary license here. Notoriously, God as a character, as an entity, as a being, is not mentioned in the scroll of Esther. But nonetheless, the rabbinic tradition, of course, has God behind the scenes the whole time. And Cotton Mather was a very well-read, including in rabbinics, a well-read individual, of course. And so he saw the figure of Esther as someone inspired by God who could in turn inspire others to follow God. So that was Cotton Mather's take on Purim, definitely not necessarily your conventional rabbinic sermon, but I guess we'll take what we can get in this regard. At the very least, when writing about Esther, he wasn't out trying to convert a Jew. So we'll take ones where we can get them.
Not rabbinic, but also maybe not pshat. I thought where you were going to go was not about the presence or absence of God in Megillat Esther, but the fact that Esther actually volunteers for and lives in a harem. One thing I was surprised to find out is how the Book of Esther was used by abolitionists all the way up to Abraham Lincoln. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So most, I think, profoundly and inspiringly, Sojourner Truth, who was born Isabella Bounfrey, got up in front of a rowdy audience of angry white men in New York City in 1853 on September 7th. And this was at a women's rights convention. And she was speaking there without notes because she could neither read nor write.
But tell us a little, just remind us about Sojourner Truth.
Sure. So she was an escaped slave who had learned the Bible, heard the Bible, and was a very, very accomplished both abolitionist and women's rights activist. She ended up actually meeting President Lincoln, and she was a legendary, courageous figure in the fight for women's rights, as well as for the abolition of slavery. And she was so courageous that she spoke unhesitatingly, you know, in this rally that became known in history as the mob convention. So disruptive were the hecklers in the crowd. And she gets up, you know, on her pathway to achieving, you know, canonical status as someone who, emerging from the shackles of slavery, helped rid America of this terrible scourge of an institution. And where does she turn in this moment, in this harsh and fraught context? She says as follows. She says, I have only a few minutes to speak, but in the old times, the kings of the earth would hear a woman. There was a king in the scriptures, and then it was the kings of the earth would kill a woman if she come into their presence. But Queen Esther come forth, for she was oppressed and felt there was a great wrong. And she said, I will die or I will bring my complaint before the king. Should the king of the United States be greater or more crueler or more harder? And she turned to Queen Esther and in this, her own Esther moment, and put on the mantle, the malchut, if you will. She put on the mantle, the royal garb of Esther, advocating for women's rights. And she actually went deeper with her Dvar Torah. She said, the king, he raised up his scepter and said, "Thy request shall be granted unto thee, to the half of my kingdom will I grant it to thee." Then he said he would hang Haman on the gallows he had made up high, but that is not what women come forward to contend. The women want their rights as Esther. Now, women do not ask half of the kingdom, but their rights, and they don't get them. The king ordered Haman to be hung on the gallows, which he prepared to hang others. But she reassured her audience, "I do not want any man to be killed, but I am sorry to see them so short-minded. We'll have our rights. See if we don't. And you can't stop us from them. See if you can." So this was Sojourner Truth in the fight for equality in America, turning to none other than the Jewish queen of ancient biblical times. If only our own politicians would be so eloquent in turning to, maybe we could get into them a little bit later, but in turning to and citing the Bible often, you know, without notes and just seeing their own circumstances as being like Esther, about an individual thrust through no fault of her own, through no maneuverings of her own, into a position where they could affect positive change in the world and save their people. I find this endlessly fascinating and endlessly inspiring.
Let's jump to contemporary times for a minute. Last year, I think it was, you reviewed Jordan Gorfinkel's graphic novel of Esther for us. What did you think about it? What does he try to do there?
So I think Gorf, as I believe he insists on being referred to, as did a fantastic job of putting together what, you know, some have argued, particularly Adele Berlin, former longtime professor, Bible scholar at the University of Maryland, I believe, who I think is thanked in the acknowledgments in the book. She herself classifies the genre, the literary genre of the Book of Esther, as being carnivalesque, in other words, as being essentially comic. And so I think what Gorf was trying to do is to match the tone, the style of the narrative itself, and present it in a way kind of like the way the Bible presents it to us. By that I mean something that is clearly about the forces of good versus evil, and Gorf, in his own inimitable way, does it in a way that, like comic books, is accessible to children. So at the same time that children are being entertained visually, in the case of his representation of the tale, there's a profound and important and crucial national battle being played out in between the lines or through the lines of the text. And he, I think, brilliantly conveys the profundity of the story while continuing in the tradition of presenting it in a way that is accessible to all generations as it has been throughout Jewish history. I think something particular that he did that was quite brilliant was he subtly put in sort of winks to Midrashic interpretation. So for example, so Gorf quite brilliantly shows us in illustrative form Vashi being dragged away by palace guards, which sticks to a very exact and nuanced reading of the shot, the contextual explanation, but at the same time has a thought bubble whereby she's essentially driving arrows into the back of her husband, Ahasuerus, who is cleaning a stable. And this is a very subtle way of calling back to a midrash that essentially Vashti argued that she herself was a princess. She was the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, whereas Ahasuerus was elevated to the kingdom by marrying her. And he, in fact, had his origins being a humble stable boy. So Gorf does this quite brilliantly, one smartly constructed little box. So all in all, I thought it was a exquisitely done work.
It reminded me a little bit that when I was in LA, I used to sometimes listen to a guy named Yitzhak Shalom, Rabbi Yitzhak Shalom, sure, do the Kriya, read Megillat Esther. And like others, but really brilliantly, he did the entire thing in voices.
Sure.
And so you could follow the story. You know, you would immediately hear Ahasuerus. There would be these kind of sound effects that would dramatize the way in which the story is itself a kind of graphic novel or comic book.
Did he switch hats like the reader in our neck of the woods here nearby Esther Hamalka Street, the shul down the block?
Oh, yeah? I can't remember.
Well, this guy does a fantastic job of switching hats based on the character who he's voicing.
Maybe that's a way to go farther afield. What are your favorite uses of the Esther story in American pop culture?
I think at this point, we can agree that independent of your thoughts on him, you know, Donald Trump becoming president essentially rid ourselves of any distinction we had between popular culture and political culture in America. And so I think I see these two as essentially bleeding into each other. And so when you ask me about popular culture, I would respond by saying in political culture, Esther is everywhere. She has always been everywhere, and she continues to be, maybe even at a rate that is faster than Con Mather could crank out 8 more books. So for example, and she, by the way, cuts across political lines as well. So, in no particular order, along the Republican line, Trump's last press secretary, I believe her name is pronounced Kylie McEnany, published an autobiography of her short time being in the White House, and it was titled, "For Such a Time as This, My Faith Journey Through the White House and Beyond." And it's in fact not only Republicans who turned to her. Mayor Eric Adams of New York, he on the campaign trail in multiple contexts said things along the lines of, here's just one quote, "Esther 4:14 in the Bible stated, 'God made me for such a time like this. The uniqueness of my experience,' he was talking about having been a police officer, 'will allow me to ensure that we can have both of these entities.'" He was discussing a strong police diligence while, of course, maintaining a sense of racial justice and equality. So whether you're Eric Adams coming from the Democratic Party or Nikki Haley and the Trump administration coming from the Republican side of things, you turn to Esther. And during actually Trump's presidency, Mike Pompeo suggested that, I don't know if you're sitting down for this, but he suggested that Trump himself was a modern day Queen Esther sent to save today's Jewish people from destruction. And he actually mused, this was in the context of the debate over getting rid of the Iran nuclear agreement. Secretary Pompeo mused, "Could it be that President Trump right now has been sort of raised for such a time as this, just like Queen Esther, to help save the Jewish people from the Iranian menace?" So Esther is everywhere, and she won't stop scrolling through the ages. Actually, Elise Stefanik said from the floor and then tweeted, "Jim Jordan should be Speaker of the House." And she said, "As this body convenes for the sacred responsibility to elect the next Speaker of the People's House, I am reminded of the Book of Esther. For such a time as this, Jim Jordan will be America's Speaker for such a time as this." Spoiler alert, he was not chosen. But yet, I'm sure Esther will continue, will brush herself off and pop back up again when you least expect it.
I think the one that surprised me the most was Eric Adams. I just never thought.
Didn't see that one coming.
Mayor
huh?
Adams is.
But look, I think it's worth noting, of course, as we mentioned, that Esther seems to be a figure that resonates with people independent of, obviously, their faith tradition, the color of their skin, their gender, their political affiliation. People love Esther.
Before we go, is there some story from your book that we didn't hit that you'd like to?
I'm always looking for an excuse to talk about my favorite American Jewish historical figure, Mordechai Emanuel Noah, and I would be remiss if we left him out. He was a Philadelphia-born prominent playwright, a journalist, an editor, a sheriff, a lawyer, and a diplomat. He briefly served as America's man in Tunis, one of the Barbary states in North Africa, and he was actually fired because he was a Jew, or at least that was the official reason given. He convinced a wealthy friend of his named Samuel Leggett to spend 16 grand, close to 17 grand, at the time an enormous amount, on 2,000 acres in 1824 in upstate New York that he planned to call Ararat, which would be the at least temporary homeland safe haven of the Jews in the United States of America. This was around 50 years after America's independence. And there he would unite or reunite the Jewish people from across the globe. Unfortunately, nobody listened to this. He got it from the right and the left. The rabbis of Europe did not heed his call, and they insisted that to hasten the redemption would be essentially heretical. On the left, fascinatingly, there was a Maskilic journal, an Enlightenment journal, that really took Mordechai to task. And this is why I bring this up, because they went to his first name. And they said roughly in this journal, this Enlightenment journal, said, well, you know, Ish Yehudi Haya Betzfon America. There was a man in North America, Ushmo Mordechai, paraphrasing and playing with the Ish Yehudi Haya B'Shushan HaBira verse of the Megillah, and said as follows, this Mordechai should not be Ratzoi lo lerovachav, lo lema'atachav, lo leksatachav. Not even a few people, forget the majority, No one, not even the teeniest, tiniest minority of Jews, should take this Mordechai seriously. So this is a rabbinic inside baseball move. But the Talmud says, with regard to one of the closing verses of the Megillah, that Mordechai, the Jewish leader, was ratzoi lerov echav. Seemingly, he was accepted by most of his brethren, the majority of his brethren, as having been a successful and wise Jewish leader. And the Talmud comments, perhaps with an acknowledgement that no Jewish leader can ever please all Jews. They said he was ratzoi lerov echav lo lechol echav. He pleased most of the Jews of his time and not all of the Jews. And so Mordechai's plans went for naught. They went up in smoke, and he spent his later years trying to build up the case for the Jewish return to the land of Israel, giving speeches about it in 1848, 100 years before the rebirth of the modern state of Israel. But what I think makes his story so compelling is that it touches upon essentially what is the story of Esther about? And by that I mean, is it a story that should give succor and inspiration to American Jews, to diaspora Jews? Of course, the story of the Book of Esther takes place in exile and diaspora, in Shushan, in a faraway land that's not Israel. And is it meant to give a imprimatur or support to those who, for whatever reason, find themselves outside of the land of Israel? Or is it meant as a critique? Or is it meant as almost a satire, making fun of the Jews for not being in Israel and saying, well, all this bad stuff, this Haman, Achashverosh going after you, that's all because you're not where you need to be. And fascinatingly, in recent years, this debate has emerged from Israeli scholars, maybe not surprisingly. Many of them, Jonathan Grossman at Bar-Ilan University, Rabbi Menachem Lutag at the Gush, Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun, Rabbi Bini Lau, preeminent religious Zionist figures, have argued that the Megillah is written in a way, especially if one presumes it took place when the Second Temple was already rebuilt, without getting bogged down in the details, if Achashverosh is Xerxes, that means historically that we were a good few decades into the Second Temple period, i.e. the Jews should, by right, at least by spiritual calling, should have gone back from places like Shushan to the rebuilding effort of the temple, already in operation for a good few years now in the land of Israel. And so, according to this reading, what the book does is essentially flip things and say, well, you diaspora Jews, you're just spinning your wheels. You're like Mordechai Emanuel Noah, mistaking a foreign place for the land of Israel. That's a long way of saying this is an endlessly fascinating, rich, resonant for all sorts of audiences.
I thought it was a long way of saying that I and all our listeners should make Aliyah.
Well, you said it, not me, but I second the motion, those who are able to. But I'm not here judging anyone who can't, of course. According to some of my you know, co-religionists in the land of Israel, the Book of Esther is judging you. But you can take that up with them, and I would love to be there eating popcorn at that debate.
Spoken like a true recent Ola. Let's end on a deep note. What's your favorite kind of hamantaschen?
I mean, without a doubt, it would have to be raspberry. If anyone likes chocolate or prune, I'm very sorry, but we can't be friends. I mean, maybe if you mend your evil ways and come over to the Jedi side of the Force and join me and take the red pills or the red hamantaschen, that is. Definitely raspberry all the way.
I'm going to put in a plug for the classic mon, the poppy seed.
This can be a machlok of Hashem Shemayim, an argument that will, I'm sure, continue and is for the sake of heaven. So, you know, agree to disagree.
Okay. Stu, it's been a pleasure. Please come back soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again to Stu Halpern for coming on the podcast. The JRB podcast is a production of the Jewish Review of Books, and it was produced by Akiva Schick. You can read Stu's work at thejewishreviewofbooks.com and subscribe to our podcast via Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts. Oh, and leave us a 5-star review. The algorithm likes that. Meanwhile, keep reading.